Hello and welcome to Android Developers Backstage, the podcast. Who am I today? I'll play the part of Chet Haas. I am on the Android UI Toolkit team.
I'm still Tor Norby on the Android Tools team.
I'm sorry about that.
And I'm Chris Craik from the UI Toolkit team.
We have been trying forever to get Chris on the show, and it's so difficult to get time on his schedule that finally it worked out. It's really impressive.
Wait, did we just out him as the person who's been ditching us over and over again?
Well, I wasn't going to specifically call out to it, but sure. So if you detect any animosity in the show today, any hard feelings, they're there. So just to start things off on the right foot.
Absolutely.
Welcome.
For the listeners at home, Tor was doing air quotes. Why, when people do air quotes, why do you do it twice? Because that's like four quotes on each side.
It could even be quote?
Like one single.
No, yeah. I'm double quotes.
No, you did it correctly. You did it once, but most people, like including me, like you'll do a couple, right?
Oh.
You tweak it twice, and then it's like you squared your quotes. Like you could even do one. You could just put your finger up and just have a quote, but no, you have to actually dink your fingers in, and then usually you do it twice.
Isn't it like Python or something where you have triple quotes and that makes it like a multi-line literal?
Yes.
So that's what they're doing.
You think people are doing Python quotes?
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
I like it. Okay. So today we thought we would try to have Chris on the podcast again to talk about performance. So the area that Chris focuses on is performance. Tools, runtime tools, analysis tools, as well as just fixing stuff to make it go faster. Fairly deep down. I'll let you maybe talk about it instead of me. Go.
Sure. So the project that I work on within the UI Toolkit is known as the Hardware Renderer. I work on the component that that sits in between the view system and the actual OpenGL drivers, the graphics libraries themselves, that translates sort of canvas drawing commands, the primitives that the Android view system provides, into OpenGL. And so, like generating shaders and matrices and transforms and meshes and so on. But as Chet said, I also spend a whole lot of my time because you know I focus on performance all throughout the system on tools as well as fixes across the view system and elsewhere.
So the system you're working on, if anybody has seen like some of the videos that we've done on this or the conference talks or articles where we talk about displayless in Android, that's basically where you spend a lot of your time.
Yep.
The display list is it's the data structure where we keep the information that we translated from the canvas drawing commands into this intermediate representation that we cache and then eventually turn that into GL commands.
Yep.
And there's a whole lot of code and a whole lot of optimization opportunities there. But there's also, I think, even more opportunities at the application level, which is why you spend a lot of your time on figuring out what applications are doing and how they're using the APIs and how they might use them better and how we might implement them better to avoid some of the pitfalls that people fall into.
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of my time is spent working on diving exactly into why applications are having performance problems and, you know, fixing them across the releases when there's something that the platform can fix, but also working on documenting and helping out with tools to help developers themselves realize, oh, this small change that I can make in my code can actually make things significantly faster.
Okay, so speaking of tools,
yes.
So the most recent stuff that I know you worked on was mentioned briefly at I/O, but it was the fairly substantial changes that were made to SysTrace.
Yeah, so talk a little bit about SysTrace. I think you may have mentioned it on one of the previous podcasts, just going over the tools. But basically, SysTrace is our system-wide tracing tool that allows you to tell what every thread, process, and the kernel is doing throughout a captured session on your device. So basically, you start tracing, you do something interesting, say scroll a list, pull out a drawer, do whatever you want. And once that trace is captured, you get an HTML file out, and you look at all of the details of what's going on in the system.
And is that an easy thing to do?
So historically,
with a leading question.
Thank you for that leading question, that subtle leading question. So no, it absolutely hasn't been, because this tool has from the outset basically been optimized for presenting as much information as possible without necessarily making it easy to onboard, like to onboard new users, to learn exactly how to use the tool. And so over the past release, we've done like We've done a lot of work, and one, improving the usability of the tool by hiding and sorting a lot of the information so that it you know, gets a good 50% of that cruft out of your face so that you don't have to worry about, you know, some thread pinging on some application in the background, just doing some tiny little bit of network activity. You know, that's far and away outside of your view. But also documenting this process as well and adding some new features to the tool to help you find exactly what the system is doing, explain a few things, and call out problems to the user so that they understand, hey, this is not only bad, this is bad and fixable, and here's the next step to go to fixing that.
So do you have some examples?
Yeah, sure. So what the tool does now, the tool will label all of the frames in the entire trace, all of the frames produced by the UI toolkit, and it'll grade them basically based upon their latency. On a typical Android device, 60 hertz VSync, you have between 14 and 16 milliseconds to produce your frame in order to get it to the to the GPU and not to the compositing service and not drop a frame. So within that 16 milliseconds, you have to do all of the work on the UI thread and allow the render thread on L devices, or just the rendering process in general, like issuing commands to the GPU, finish within that 16 milliseconds. So the issues that it can call out are things like, hey, you did this really expensive giant layout. Maybe you should look at, you know, at reworking your layouts. Here's some links about information about that. Or, hey, look, this particular rendering was very slow, and that's because of view alpha. You hit one of the tricky view, those tricky expensive view alpha patterns, and you can optimize that by flipping this flag or changing this thing or using a hardware layer or whatnot, and it goes into the detail of exactly what you need to do to fix that inside the tool.
That's shown per frame, or it's sort of summarized on the bottom, or how does that work?
So there are multiple places that it's shown. So you can click on individual frames, and it'll tell you problems with the frames. So the frames are colored basically like, you know, green, it's good, don't worry about it. You know, yellow or red, investigate these, figure out why they were slow and took a long time to produce. And you can click on the frame, you can see that information. There's an alert pane at the right side where you can click on the alert pane, see all the alerts in the system, which is in the entire trace. Which is really, really useful because you can basically treat that as a bug list of like, these are all the different classes of problems that I had and the number of times that each one of them happened. You know, look, I've got, you know, 17,000 issues with alpha. Well, very often that's because you have a huge number of frames that are very similar and, you know, you fix a couple of tiny little cases and all of those go away, gets much faster.
So I'm assuming that, you know, the 14 to 16 milliseconds, that's constant, regardless of what your hardware is, right? But I'm thinking that if you did this capture with top-of-the-line hardware and it's all green, it might not be green if you have, you know, second-tier device. Do we have any sort of recommendations or ways to figure out, hey, this is okay in your case, but probably not a case for – probably not okay for a vast majority of
– Yeah. Absolutely. So one of the common pieces of recommendation is that you should always test on the slowest devices that you can get your hands on. And so, you know, using the top-of-the-line model that's as fast as possible, best GPU, yeah, you're not going to get as useful of data because, you know, of course it's going to do better than something that's slower. But if, you know, you want all of your users to have a great experience, then, you know, try out the slow device, fix it there. And once it's performing smoothly on a slow device, your fast devices will just fly without any extra effort from you. So, you know, testing on those. And part of this is also is a bit psychological of just using and testing your own application on a slow device, getting in the habit of, you know, experiencing that, because that's what a lot of customers that, like, a lot of your users will be using. And, you know, if your focus is developing for phones, you might have a large budget for a phone that, you know, that doesn't represent what your user base has.
So do you have a slow device that you prefer to use?
Yes. So I use a lot of the let's see, it kind of depends on different cases. I really enjoy the Zoom back when that was available. and I guess it's still available for application developers. But also Nexus 4, not an extremely fast device these days, but still a really great device for testing on because you know the bottlenecks on that device are just so much tighter than something that's just top of the line these days.
And the 14 and 16 milliseconds, that's mostly for CPU-bound stuff, so it doesn't really vary with the graphics card. Is the overhead of the back end sort of constant across?
Well, so to give a little bit more explanation there, so that's actually all of the CPU cost as well as the GPU cost. So the expectation is that the way that the system works is that there's a VSync that happens throughout the system every 16 milliseconds that is synchronized both with the output display VSync, like the analog to the hardware VSync of displays, and then you've got your input, which traditionally uses something very similar, uses the same clock for sampling. So you know your input may average a couple of samples together, but basically there's input locked in at the beginning of VSync and output pushed to composition layer at the end of that VSync gap, and it's that entire 16 millisecond window is produce the frame with the UI code and then also allow the rendering system to render.
So that's also counting your code?
Yes, that's counting my code, which is...
And how much, I guess the amount of code, the amount of your code running would depend on how much they're using graphic operations, I guess.
Yes.
So we can't say, hey, subtract 3 milliseconds for Chris.
No, and
it's going to be some percentage of graphics calls.
Yeah, so it can definitely depend upon the complexity of your scene, and so that's kind of why the tools first approach of just look at it. You can see this in the tool very clearly of this is how long the rendering operation took on the native layer of the actual generation of GL commands, and this is how much time it spent on the UI thread. So a little bit more context there. Things have changed drastically from prior to the L release versus the L release because we moved all of this rendering operation onto another thread. And that's not necessarily because we want parallelism between those two. Pipeline parallelism will give you extra latency if we wanted to like shift it into a different VSync slot. But really the use there is that the render thread can proceed with a known slow UI thread. So when you're inflating an activity or something along those lines. And that's what I was referring to, the render thread and work over there, but it's not necessarily pipelined in that way. It's just UI thread does its work. It hands the work over to the render thread in a standard frame, and you can see all of that, see exactly where the time is going. And yeah, again, the really useful part of some of the new SysTray stuff is just being able to click on that and just have explanations in line. This is what the system is doing. Let me explain that to you in more than one word.
The very cool thing about that is that that stuff is that it basically comes from your head and the heads of other people that have been working with SysTray. So the way it's worked internally is that the tool was developed and then we used it internally, and there were basically like a small handful of people who actually understood the output, and then apps teams would, you know, run the tool and not quite understand the output, and then talk to this group of people, including yourself, to understand what it was trying to tell them. And in a lot of cases, especially that caused jank on the screen, it would boil down to, oh, well, you're running layout during your animation, right? So the reason you are seeing jank there and missing like 3 frames in the middle of the animation is something happened in your application to cause a layout. And you can see that because, you know, this little trace down here indicates that you're doing this bad thing. And so we would see that over and over again, but the app developers who didn't really use the tool regularly wouldn't really understand the complex output. So what you've taken is that knowledge of, okay, these are common patterns that the tool surfaces, and we can look in the trace and detect, okay, well, this thing is running during, you know, an animation thing, and we know that's a bad thing. So it's
yeah, absolutely. So I mean, to summarize it, it's basically embedding the knowledge of the people that are really experienced with it inside the tool itself. It'll say like it will actually tell you, hey, this layout took more than 3 milliseconds while you were rendering. Don't do that. And you know, it'll actually go into like it's not just saying you're doing something wrong, but it's saying like, hey, you might look for relative layouts. You might look for like nesting things that might explode. Here's a link to a performance tutorial video that, you know, tells you more about exactly this problem.
So you've essentially obsoleted yourself, but in a good way.
Yeah. Hopefully a good way.
Well, okay. Now you can work on porting it to Android Studio. That would be nice.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's see. So that's SysTrace.
Yes.
Which we've talked about before. So the changes that you talked about were discussed and released at I/O.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get the preview release, you will get that version of that tool. Or actually, is it in the latest platform tools that you would get? So where do people run this? We'll post a link on the show notes where they can get SysTrace. But if you download the preview release, you will have the executable that gives you this
yes.
stuff. Okay. So you mentioned alpha.
Alpha.
So
yes.
a lot of the information you embedded in there comes from the fact that over and over and over again we see performance problems coming from the use of alpha. So
you should just wait till the beta version is available. It's much better.
Yeah, so the tricky thing about alpha is that it's a really easy concept to understand, but it's also a really complex one to implement when you have to think about all the different corner cases. And what that means is that it's very easy to trigger a very slow path in the Android view system by just using something that seems like a very simple component in the abstract when you're saying, I'm just making this thing transparent. But once you understand, oh, well, actually, in order to make something transparent and not sort of show through this weird transparency into itself, you have to draw that to an off-screen buffer. And drawing to an off-screen buffer creates extra overdraw. It creates extra work that the GPU has to do. And it's incredibly expensive because there's no caching associated with alpha in the same way that there might be with a layer. So there are different ways of getting around the cost of using an off-screen buffer. Mainly that you can either dedicate a caching buffer to that view permanently or temporarily for the duration of your alpha animation with the layering APIs, or you can opt out of this slow behavior of using an off-screen buffer with has overlapping rendering by basically saying I don't have overlapping rendering. The reason that you're allocating an off-screen buffer for this view, it's not necessary.
What is overlapping rendering?
So the reason that you need an off-screen buffer in order to implement alpha is traditionally, think of a case where a view, and this is a very naive, silly view, but it draws a blue rectangle and then it draws a red rectangle directly on top of that. If you were to naively say, I want to make this view 50% transparent by drawing all of its content at 50% transparency.
The top view.
Hmm?
The top view. You want to draw the red thing on top.
Well, no, they're both one view
with both colors.
So so super naive view of like it's doing unnecessary work by having this blue rectangle behind this red one.
Okay.
But if you make both of them transparent when you're drawing the view, you'll suddenly have something that fades not only into transparency but through the color purple as it goes because as the color on top becomes transparent, it reveals the color below, and so they get blended together, and you reveal things that you don't want to.
So actually a more realistic and common example is if we did this with a button, then you would have the background of the button and then you would have the text. And what you would end up seeing is the stuff – like the text would actually blend with the background color, which it should not. It should be opaque on top of that background color and then blended on top of whatever's behind the button.
Yes. So the way that the view system knows, though, whether or not you have overlapping rendering is this flag within view, this Boolean that you can override this has overlapping rendering method, and so a lot of the common simple views will and base classes will do this so that they can get the efficient behavior as easily as possible. Like image view will say, "Oh, I've only got a single bitmap drawable." Like that's clearly a simple case, and then it will return, "I don't have overlapping rendering. You don't need to use the expensive alpha path." So internally, the view system will be able to say, "Oh, I'm not going to bother with all that extra work. I'll just change the opacity of that." That's the equivalent to if you just had the text and not a background, or if you just had the red and not the blue. And so that's something that we highly suggest for people implementing custom views is to if you're doing an alpha animation, this is one of the great ways of getting around a lot of that cost is by opting out of the expensive behavior.
Because the default behavior for that flag for the method that you would need to override is true. Because we don't know for any given view whether it actually has overlapping rendering or not. And the main priority of the framework is to deliver content that actually looks like it's supposed to on the screen.
But I guess if you're a developer, you should, even if you're not sure, even if you don't understand what you just talked about, you should try switching it off and seeing if it still looks good. Because if it does, then you're fine.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, I mean, hopefully you'll spend a couple of minutes and understand what we're talking about as well.
Hey, that looks good to me. I'm not a designer, but
it's actually easier. It's a little tricky on an audio only medium to describe what we're talking about. It's very easy with pictures to show the before and after of both cases, and then it's a little easier to get it.
But. Which is actually a great segue into the Android performance patterns videos that have been going out over the past few months. of there are some videos that do a really great job of explaining this this content, and you can just search on YouTube for Android performance patterns.
Yeah, we'll put the link on the show notes
okay.
as well.
And basically it's just all these videos explaining from the very beginning, like how does the Android view system render, how do you solve this particular like bitmap loading, how do you solve view alpha, all of these things they go through with visual examples, a lot easier to see than our hand gestures here.
Yes, but has overlapping rendering. Good thing to know about. In particular, so it came up a few months ago internally, like we don't just talk about these things that external developers should do. Instead, like we spend most of our time actually thinking about the code that we are writing and trying to fix and optimize internally. And one of those areas was when you had looked at a performance problem in the Wear platform,
mm-hmm.
and it turned out to be embedded in their use of alpha for a particular experience that they were trying to get. And at least part of that fix was around the use of has overlapping rendering.
Yes.
Because right? They were basically falling exactly into the slow path and doing more work or causing the framework to do more work than they really needed.
I think this was like last summer. And I think that the Moto 360 went from laggy to smooth. It was like an incredible difference in that build when that fix went in.
Yeah, so I spent a couple of days with that team and the Vue code was all by and large really good. The tricky part was that there were just a couple of places just distributed all throughout the system of just this assumption that alpha was fast and this lack of knowledge that actually it's very easy to get into these expensive cases. So using these tools and using just, a few lines of code changes, we were able to get up to a much more stable high frame rate than previous.
One of the unobvious things about frame rate is that it works on a system of harmonics where, like, even if they were essentially able to get, like, 55 frames a second from the performance they were going to get 30. Right, like as soon as you drop down at a 60, you're gonna go down to 30. Right, the frame rate does not scale according to how fast you can go. Instead, it goes in these large increments. Like if you miss that frame, you miss the entire frame, and you have to catch it the next time around, which is going to be twice as long as you would have caught it as you would have gotten had you caught the first frame. So yeah, it went from so it probably wasn't that bad internally, but just the fact that if you're not at 60, you're at 30 meant that it went from a noticeably slow frame rate to a noticeably smooth one. So very cool. Let's see, what's other stuff? Oh, you mentioned bitmap loading, right? So this is something you had worked on a couple of years ago. You'd worked on some internal app and you were playing around with like bitmap caching and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So on the way over here, I was saying, do you want to talk about sort of strategies for bitmap loading? And I think your answer for that now is?
Use Glide. That's it. Basically, just use the Glide library. So the Glide library is one that will take advantage of all of basically those recommendations that we have for bitmap loading. So prior to the release of ART, bitmaps were a very easy cause for GC blocking GC jank because you'd allocate a new bitmap while you were scrolling through a list, and that would tickle the GC in an unfortunate way that would cause it, to pause for long enough for you to drop one or two frames, and very reliably. It was very, very tricky to get around, and so the recommendation has always been, recycle these bitmaps when you can, and that's there are APIs that have evolved across the different platform versions, and so there's also another performance patterns video that talks about this problem and exactly how you go through loading asynchronously, doing things on the background, not loading too large of images, but recycling them whenever you can. But again, the thesis is, if the library can do it for you, by all means, use it.
One of our earliest episodes, we interviewed the Ficus about the Volley library, which was an image loading library. I wonder if we need to update that podcast now and talk to whoever's working on Glide.
I don't think it was specifically an image loading library, right? Wasn't it networking in
Volley
general?
Volley is general networking. Glide actually can sit on top of Volley.
Oh,
okay. So it did a certain amount of bitmap stuff, but I think that was just like, and they also needed this. So that was part of what it offered, but it wasn't a full-fledged solution. And hopefully Glide is. It's also worth mentioning, so one of the things that ART did, one of the reasons that bitmap GC interactions got at least a lot better in ART was now they have like a dedicated space for large objects, the large object heap or whatever, some really fancy name for it. So it's actually a lot faster because you don't go through the same GC contortions when you need to collect these things or to find memory for other objects around these. really large dedicated spaces for bitmap. So things got a lot better, but still GC continues to be a concern.
What's a large object in terms of an image?
More than 2 bytes.
I'm just thinking that,
how do they classify between large object heap and small object heap?
I'm just thinking when you're scrolling through an app that has images, they tend to be like thumbnails. They seem really small to me. So I'm just wondering if the definition is, hey, it's more than 16 bytes, or if it's, hey, we're going to use this for images that are,
I don't think it's based on image type. I'm going to speak without knowing what I'm talking about, which is a really common pattern that I drive to. I would assume that it's some heuristic based on pure size. Yeah. I would assume that thumbnails fall into it because, frankly, once you get up to, these thumbnails you're talking about, they may not be huge, but they're going to be
HDPI
like most of the width of the screen and a couple hundred pixels tall, and all of a sudden you're up into a bunch of bytes, right? So, 16 bytes, probably not. But an image is gonna fall over into that category pretty easily.
Especially with the screen density we have now.
Yeah. Actually, so speaking of which, we were talking about low-end devices earlier. One of the interesting things to try to test for, and one of the things that I know you did a couple of years ago, so the original Nexus 7 was a pretty good device because it was one of those devices. The Zoom was actually the first one of these where all of a sudden the screen size went up by a much larger factor than the CPU and GPU power, right? So all of a sudden we're forced on the framework side into the situation of trying to fill many, many more pixels, knowing that like as the width and the height increase, all of a sudden like a screen that's twice as big just gave us 4 times as many pixels, right? And the density is going up at the same time.
Well, the Nexus 7 had the TV DPI density, which was really special.
Yes, yes.
Has that ever been repeated? Do we know of any other devices that used it? No, I
don't
guess not.
Know offhand. Let's see. Anyway, so we've got this problem of like filling all these pixels, but the GPUs didn't necessarily go up at that 4x rate. And so it's really good to find devices not just with like slower CPUs, but higher density screens.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then you can easily test for like problems that your app is going to run into with, overdraw, where we're simply filling too many pixels for the GPU to do efficiently.
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, it was very simple to say that you try and find old devices, try and find devices that aren't as CPU powerful, but absolutely find the ones that that don't prefer that have a less than ideal ratio of GPU performance power to pixel.
And overdraw, did you want to talk about that?
Sure, yeah.
At all?
So overdraw is another thing that apps can actually accidentally run into if they're not aware of the cost. So overdraw is the general description for the high level label for the classic problem of you're producing too much drawing content. And so in the view system, it's very easy to say, I want the background of this thing to be this color. I want the background of this thing to be this color without thinking through like what the system has to do in order to implement that. And the way that the view system works is it's very low level from the rendering perspective of anything that you explicitly ask us to fill as a background is something that the GPU will happily do. But there's a very, very simple one-to-one mapping between the work that you're doing in the GPU and the work that the GPU needs to do as well. So if you declare like a background on your window, which is there by default, you'll probably want to use that. But if you also declare one on an activity and a fragment, and then also in your recycled list item, suddenly you've got a lot of work that the GPU is doing to fill these background layers before it draws the thing on top and ends up wasted work because whatever ends up on top is opaque.
Is any of that stuff? Can you optimize any of that out at the level that so the display list, right?
Yes.
If you see that you have an opaque window on top of it, can you just drop the whole background paint, or is that?
Yes, actually, we do have that optimization in. In fact, so basically the way that it works is that if you're drawing a rectangle and you recognize like while we're processing display list operations that hey this is an opaque operation that's covering the entire thing and we throw absolutely everything that's underneath it away, and so in a lot of practical cases that will throw away your background your window background if you have declared it on top, but the recommendation in general is don't rely on that behavior because it doesn't exist on older devices, and just for the pure for basically the sake of simplicity and minimizing the amount of work that the framework needs to do, just use your window background as the background color for your application if you have one. Like, so if you have, say, a gray background on your activity that, you know, has white list view items scrolling on top of it, then if you're never going to see past the list view items to that gray isn't really the background so much as that list view item color white is. And there's a lot of details and lots of experimentation that
so
you can
do.
So
then what there. Do? You set the window background to null? Or?
So you could set the window background to white, and you could get rid of the background for the list view items. And what that does is, and this is actually the default behavior of a list view, is to have, you know, is, you know, you pass views in. If you don't declare any backgrounds, they'll be transparent, they won't be drawn, and you can just rely on the one simple trivial fill for the GPU, which is just fill the entire screen white at the very beginning of the frame to do a lot of that work for you.
There are some unrelated issues that can come up if you have a null background on the window. There are ways to do it very poorly, which results in some very obvious and ugly artifacts. And there are even ways where when you're doing it, I'm going to do like an error quad quote here correctly. You can still run into artifacts where the window manager would really like to show the background of the window, but there is none, and so it won't do the right thing. So, you know, when the keyboard is animating up into the screen, maybe you're actually going to see back into the background of something that doesn't exist, right? So in general, you really do want a window background. So then make it actually work for you and do the right thing instead of causing overdraw.
Yeah, generally the contract is, it is the application's responsibility to fill its entire content with opaque pixels. And the window background by default in any of the themes will do that for you. The moment that you null out the window background, you're going to have to take control of that, of all of that behavior yourself. And there are several cases where the view hierarchy will resize your inner content, the content views that you have specified without anything behind them other you know, in that empty space, namely in keyboard resize, as Chet points out. And it's very hard to maintain that contract unless you do very special trickery.
Keyboard resize, you just mean bringing up the software keyboard. That's what you mean by that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's something they should test if they've done this.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. So, okay. So these are the problems with having overdraw, but then how do you detect it?
Yeah. So there's an option in developer options to turn on overdraw visualization, which will show you
a drug trip.
A bit of one, yes. Yeah. So it'll show you a sort of a rainbow of colors of how bad the overdraw is anywhere on the screen. So you can see that red is several layers of overdraw, that no extra drawing content, no tinting. Is good. There's zero overdraw, but then, you know, in a standard app, what you'll have is you'll have, like, say, text on top of your activity background. Like, say, in the simple list view case that I was talking about before, the text will be blue because it's one layer of overdraw over the window background. And then maybe if you have something underneath that text, like a highlight for that particular button, like a highlight state, then, you know, that entire region will be one layer more overdrawn because of that highlight state, so the text will be green and the background will be blue and so on and so forth.
Right. And a certain amount of overdraw is unavoidable, especially if you have alpha effects like drop shadows or the text on a button background. Like, well, you're clearly not going to have a background that has cut out for the text. So you do expect some amount of overdraw. What you really want to avoid is a lot of overdraw across most of your application's window.
Yes. Yeah, so little tiny bits of red, probably okay. By and large, what you want to see is as much non-tinted, non-overdrawn space as possible. Blue is fine, and, you know, green and, you know, a fairly small amount of your window is fine as well.
Aim for
and these colors don't
color.
Seem to be in logical progression, so you just memorized what each color means?
You can memorize them. There's a video that explains it.
Red usually
red
means bad.
I
would like
how
to.
How is blue related to green or red?
It goes from nothing, no overdraw, to green, which is, you know, that's pretty good. It's just one. And then blue is the next one, right?
The other way around.
See? My point exactly.
I was just trying to demonstrate the point. Sure.
Well, it would be nice if there was a way for me just to enable that SysTrace would record it and flag, hey, there was an excessive amount of overdraw in some of these frames, but I'm guessing that's
Yeah, I mean, so systrace will actually notice some of these things that can cause overdraw. So the simple cases, if you've got overlapping content, those are pretty easy to find with the overdraw indication. Just, you know, look for red, get rid of it where you can, remove unnecessary backgrounds. But there are also other cases that are effectively overdraw, even though they aren't extra layers that your application has declared, namely in layering cases. So if you have something that is has a 50% alpha, it's hitting the inefficient the naive alpha path of off-screen buffer drawing back, we count that as an extra layer of overdraw because it really is. It's mm-hmm. it's an extra pass that the GPU has to do. Similarly, if you've got a hardware layer or software layer, if you have a hardware layer because you're drawing off-screen in order to update that buffer, if you are up in any frame that you update a hardware layer on recent versions of Android, it will count that double for your overdraw and show you like that's. That's particularly problematic, but both of those things, view alpha and layer updates, are both shown within the systrace tool.
I was thinking when we were talking about the colors in systrace earlier as well that maybe it would be good to have like an extra level of badness. Like we should go with the maps model where it goes up to red, and red is pretty bad, and you're going to suffer on the way home in traffic. But if it's red and black, you just avoid that. So if your app actually has like red and black colors everywhere, just uninstall it. Just don't even go there at all. Let's see. I don't know if there's other stuff you wanted to talk about.
Sure, I can talk about some of the some of ListView and RecyclerView stuff from a performance perspective. Yeah, absolutely. So talked a lot about rendering today, about a lot of the rendering cases that can bite you if you're not aware, and tools that you can use to investigate and improve them. But one of the easy cases to one of the common cases for bad performance in an application is just having an inefficient adapter. And your adapter in like a scrolling focused environment, whether that's a list view or a recycler view, like your adapter is incredibly important. It's what will bind content to your list view, but a naively written adapter or one that does incredibly expensive work, like accessing a database or accessing disk or network or any of these things, like it can be extremely costly, and it's work that's done every time that you inflate a list item. So optimizing your adapter is incredibly important, and so that's some of the work gone into systrace as well. And so this was actually really productive for the folks that were writing the Android the IO app for 2015. There was some really inefficient adapter stuff that, you know, systrace calls out of like, hey, look, this is doing some inflation and it's rebinding. Rebinding shouldn't involve inflation if at all possible. And systrace will call those things out and highlight those problems, tell you exactly what to look at. And you can go one step further, of course, for things that are happening on the UI thread in your application code and in framework code by using trace view, which will allow you to look at either method-based profiling or the relatively recent sample-based profiling to allow you to see like, okay, well, where's my actual time being spent? And so if you know that you've written a really efficient, very simple adapter that does the minimum amount of work to rebind views or add new ones, you can exactly see where the problems are if you're doing unnecessary work.
Yeah, and that's integrated in Android Studio.
So, yeah, TraceView used to be one of those tools that we have to explain. You say, oh, and TraceView is really good too. Here's an issue with it. And the issue was it causes so much time in instrumenting itself to actually spit out the information that it needs to say, well, this was your code path, that it ended up like giving you incorrect timing information about your app. So it would look like you had significant method overhead where really you didn't. So I've actually gone through and optimized a bunch of stuff that resulted in net zero gain because TraceView was simply lying about what was going on. And this was the reason, or part of the reason, to go to the sample-based, mm-hmm. Which I believe is the default now, or it pops up a dialogue when you run
it
says,
does,
do you want to use sample? Or
And you probably do.
You probably do, unless you are specifically looking for like following the code path and wanting to know every single method that you went through over a given period of time, which is very useful, mm-hmm. but then don't use that for your timing information. Sample-based is much more efficient and can give you a much more realistic view of what's actually going on.
We should probably blur out the numbers in the tool when you've not done the samples. to really show, yeah, these numbers aren't really right.
Blurring can be an expensive operation. I would suggest maybe use RenderScript Intrinsic to do blurs.
Yeah, or maybe use some of the overdraw colors to kind of indicate that these are iffy.
Which ones?
Yeah, well, clearly
yellow,
blue is the most obvious one.
I would say aim for, you know, my advice about green and blue before, you know, notwithstanding, aim for the colors that make you feel the most comfortable. You know, red, nobody's comfortable with red.
No. That's true.
So just avoid it. I got nothing else.
I can keep going. There's another tool in there's another tool in inside of debugging as well. You're gesturing at me.
I am gesturing because we talked about it before, and then I totally forgot to bring it up. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. So there's another tool that has gotten introduced with the mpreview, which we call FrameStats. Basically,
oh, love that name.
Yeah. So basically, cool. What the view system does is it takes a lot of samples of exactly what time at which it enter each stage of the drawing pipeline, and you can query this and dump this from a running application. And so basically, the main purpose of this is to allow you to, in your test harness, if you've got, you know, you've already got tests that are triggering different paths through your application, well, you can additionally capture some of this timing information from within a running device to tell you exactly how smooth those frames were, how long it took to produce them. So the main metric here that the tool is dumping is basically it's dumping the last in frames around 60 or whatnot of exactly the frame latency and how it was distributed between every different stage of the pipeline. So it'll tell you we took this long to upload bitmaps, we took this long to do layout, we took this long to process input animations, that sort of thing. And you can look at this inside of your and you can capture this within your test harness. We've started doing this internally, and it's really useful at telling you here's how bad this animation is in general. Like your 99th percentile of frames is 10 milliseconds. You're great. This is not an issue. You know, no performance problems here. If you know you look at the distribution of frame timings and they're really high, you can then dig more into these numbers and use that to help you figure out like what the problem is before you even try running it manually on that particular device. So really great for test harnesses, like running slow devices, finding jank that way.
Have you made sure that the Espresso people are aware of this? Because I think it'd be really great. We had Espresso on this podcast, you know, a few months ago, and they were mentioning how when the test fails, they'll grab screenshots and whatnot. And it seems really great if I could set some other flags saying, hey, if there's jank in this app, fail the test.
Yes. So I think the people that are working on the test side of this stuff, so it was like we worked on the framework side, the dumping, but they're definitely talking to them.
Great.
Definitely in the plans.
So if I understand correctly, too, this is kind of the evolution of something we already had that was the graphics info, GFX info.
Yeah.
So if you ran the on previous releases, ADB shell dump sys GFX info,
yes,
you would get this data output that would basically tell you, you know, three or four numbers for the last 60 or 120 frames that you could then pop into a spreadsheet and analyze what was going on.
Yes.
The evolution here is that there is more information about latency in specific areas, and also we're running it all the time because it's very low overhead, right?
Yes.
So it used to be, yes, we could do this with GFX info, but in running the dump sys command, did you have to set a prop?
You had
to
enable
to
it. You had to enable it in developer options.
This because we didn't want it running all the time because it was taking a little bit of overhead. So we've eliminated that overhead, which means it's always available. You can always dump the information. You get more information out. The trade-off is the information is slightly less human readable, and I'm laughing saying that because it's not like GFX info is obvious to begin with, but it's not something you're going to dump out and go, oh, there's the problem.
Yes, they are nanosecond timestamps, so yeah.
I mean, anything you run with ADB should be data that a higher level tool should be reading and presenting in a better way,
yes,
right? So I would assume that SysTrace and other tools would basically suck this out and present it with a nice explanation.
That's definitely the long term plan. The reason that we're providing it this way first is to just let people experiment with it, embed it in whatever tool that they in.
Does SysTrace read it now?
SysTrace does not because it actually has more precise information and more like granular information. SysTrace is also slightly intrusive. Yeah. Not nearly to the degree of, like, you know, hair pulling that Chet was talking about with trace view method profiling. Like, you can really respect the signals within systrace. But it lets you get a very high level view of the same thing that systrace is telling you in terms of stages of the drawing pipeline, but with zero intrusiveness, very easily and very easily parsable.
Just out of curiosity, how much data does a systrace run generate if I have it on for 3 minutes?
So you probably won't. Well, so it depends on which tags you have enabled. So systrace has some default tags to tag to tell you to capture a lot of things that the average application developer is interested in. Like if you've got any view system activity, graphics activity, web view, any of these things, they're traced by default. If you have all of those on, you're going to overflow the buffers in much shorter than 3 minutes. So generally, what you do is you either
So the buffers, that's because it's recording all this on the device itself, and it has a certain amount of storage allocated.
Yeah, so the way that it works is that it's capturing into a ring buffer in the kernel, and that buffer is fixed size. So like usually a few megabytes is what you'll allocate for that, and as you fill that up, probably over the course of 20 seconds or so, you can either run it in a ring or and just discard old information, or you can just capture that amount of time. Generally, you do, if you're using systrace interactively, or if you're like capturing one from a test harness and presenting that, then you know 5 seconds is the default. It's pretty useful.
But there are command line options. You can give it a larger buffer. You can allocate a larger buffer, and you can tell it to record for longer. So I think the default with systrace is like a 5 second record time.
5 seconds.
And you will end up with megabytes of data in general. In these files, unless things have changed since last time.
No, it's dumping very precise information about like every single thread on the system and all sorts of interesting scheduling information from the kernel and so on and so forth.
I mean, it's basically a black box, right, for Flight Recorder. You know, you can figure out why was this so bad. You can go in there and see what were the pilots talking about.
Yeah, you can see every nasty little detail of every thread in the system.
Yeah, without actually having to go down in the ocean and find the thing. It's just sitting right in front of you.
Or the hillside, yeah.
Okay.
This took a dark turn.
It did. On that positive note, so we could stop here, and then we could certainly have you on a future episode. But I fear that we should probably start scheduling it now.
Oh yeah, that's a good
years from now. So we'll get working on that. In the meantime, any closing thoughts?
Profile your app.
Nice. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.